This is tape 4, side 1 of the continuing oral history interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 21st, 2006. Martha, when we stopped yesterday, we were at the point of the end of the 1970s, and you're moving into more of a role as Chief of Staff for Bob Rennebaum. And during the 80s, you have quite a productive period of time at the foundation. Yes. If you would talk about that a bit.
Right. Well, I view that period of time as kind of my time in management at the foundation and in supervisory management, and also in the corridors of power of Bascom Hall. Mm-hmm. And that happened to me really young in my career, which was unusual, and also as a woman. And my friend Martha Casey and I kind of comment on that she, it happened later, but I think the reason is because of the confidence that Irv Shane had in me and Bob Rennebaum had in me. And Ed Young had confidence in me as well, and he was very good, and we had wonderful things that I did with him. It's just that he left then to be president of the system. Mm-hmm. And also I was just getting started at that particular time, and we had started to do some work on a campaign. It was called Forward with Wisconsin, and the goal was only $15 million. But at that time, there were really only three staff who were doing fundraising, plus Bob.
And the year of that, Martha?
That ended in 1980.
Okay.
So, 1977. And it was for the museum. It was for the art of the recreational center on the south campus, and then it was also for the health sciences, the new health sciences center. And that was kind of the first time we got into raising money for medicine. It was a small entree into that. But it was the first kind of multidisciplinary campaign the foundation had ever done. Hmm. And at that time, worked on public relations and putting together a logo for the foundation. And by that time, really, I think I mentioned previously, is my background in journalism and training in it made me really want to make a cohesive design for the foundation. And so also I developed a lot of friendships with the people who worked in Bascom Hall, particularly in the public relations department, in the communications department. And so,
who was that then?
Well, there was John Gruber was there, particularly, and then Paul Fuchs, who was there as a designer, and there were other people doing news service and news releases, Mary Langenfeld in the library. And they were also about my age, too, because, you know, we needed some people to be friends with.
Yeah.
And there was also a group of, you know, women who got together, flamingos who met at the university club. And so, you know, I needed a group of friends, and that was a really nice time of my life. And then the other part was the music school. Irv had wanted to take some of the music groups out into the state, and he's established this program called Arts Outreach. And so Bob put me on that committee. So I met wonderful people like Joe Corey and Eunice Meskey, director of the School of Music, and other people who served on that group. But I really developed friendship with Eunice Meskey and Joe. And then Eunice and I traveled around a lot to these singing groups, and we invited the alumni in the particular areas. And that's when she laid out to me her dream of establishing an endowment for the School of Music, and how do I set up a board of visitors and this kind of thing. And because the foundation had, you know, traditionally worked in the area of the arts, you know, that's, I kind of started to work with music on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been working in these particular areas. And Irv, of course, loved music, so mm-hmm. he backed me on that. So I had been working on these different campaigns, but I think that Forward with Wisconsin was really the cohesive campaign, pulled it all together. So I became responsible for the marketing of that campaign. And then I was also responsible for the faculty campaign portion of it. And I think that was where I first got my reputation in development, because that was the first really successful faculty staff campaign that had ever been done at the university. And also I did very well in working with them on their gifts. And so the faculty had a lot of confidence in me, and we did very well financially as part of that. So, and that also boded well for then conversations I had also with the deans in setting that up, because we went to all the schools and colleges to set up that campaign. They really wanted to know what more they could do for their schools and colleges.
Martha, did you basically design that faculty campaign for fundraising?
Yes. And of course, Bob was wonderful about letting me, he set me to, I went to go see Michigan State because they had a very successful faculty staff campaign. And I went to Big Ten meetings. I always went to the Big Ten meeting, and I went to the UW system meetings. I would go to CASE conferences. He always encouraged me to go to a lot of different conferences and meetings and mm-hmm. find out the latest, what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that was very important, even to learn from smaller colleges and universities, not just the Big Ten, because he felt you could always learn from different organizations. He had been president of the National Alumni Council, which was, you know, the equivalent of CASE.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really was a proponent of sharing information. And being a good citizen and giving your time as a professional to other universities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have always carried that with me.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear later how I really carried that into women's philanthropy.
Uh-huh.
But so back to, I think, that period of time. So at the same time that I was working on the faculty staff campaign, with that campaign for Wisconsin, then Fred Winding was responsible for the state of Wisconsin, and we had activity in a lot of the cities in Wisconsin. And then we had Tim Riley working on the cities outside of Wisconsin. So and that was really unique, because, you know, Tim had to come in, and he had to battle against some tradition in that, you know, there were traditions that you really didn't spend any money on travel. I mean, it was like you rented a car to go see someone, this kind of thing. I mean, because we were so used to people coming to see us, and, you know, now, of course, we all the time we're traveling to see people.
Mm-hmm.
But we were always, you know, John Feld, again, that was his job as the accountant. He always questioned, why are you spending this money? You know, it mm-hmm. was, we were always watching our pennies, and that's good. It's a good thing that we did that. We were watching our donors' money,
mm-hmm.
and we always felt that was important for us to do. But we were just making that transition, and Tim especially, you know, where he had to fly all these places and, you know, rent cars and do things, I think he had to battle that hurdle. But Bob, of course, knew we did. We had to do it. And he was, so Tim was out on the road, and as much as one person can do. But Bill Beers, who was the chairman of Kraft, was the chair of the campaign.
Oh.
And he had his private jet, so he would zoom around with Fred and, you know, Bob, and then Tim and Bob, and go to all the visit people. And, you know, the campaign, I think we got 18 million or something. But that was a big deal at that time. And, but it, I always remember I was responsible for the public relations of it. And I had volunteered and went to Bob and said, I want to do, be responsible for the communications, because I just had said I felt that the, we were not, you know, projecting a unified image. All of our publications were being just farmed out. Let's say if Tim had wanted to do a publication, he called the printer Litho Productions, and Jeff Ritz Randolph, who we had a relationship with for years and still do. He called, you know, and say, would you get this piece designed, and here's the copy. And that, and Fred did the same thing. I mean, it was very, you know, it was not a centralized publications, office, the way I had been taught that this is the way you're supposed to do it. And then I was developing these friendships with the publications office and also Art Hovey, and felt that the foundation's image should look something like the university's.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had developed a friendship with Paul Fuchs and really admired his graphic design. He had been a student of Phil Hamilton, a wonderful, very talented graphic designer and art professor here. And so Paul had done a number of really good pieces that I liked at the university. And so I asked Art if Paul could do our pieces just on a freelance basis. And he said it was okay. So Paul did the Campaign for Wisconsin piece for us.
Oh.
And it's, it was a beautiful piece. And he also did, I remember it was an, one of the best pieces ever done, you know, for the university. It just wowed everybody because it was the first piece in color, you know. And it had really nice logos for the first time. And, I mean, then the publications on the campus were dismal. And if you looked at the, like developing what is a unified alumni plan across the campus, so far as our whole, you know, building a pyramid of development and advancement, you have to start with good communications to your alumni and professional, and so you have to look like a first-class university.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start with the, you know, the activities of the Alumni Association, and then you start with your annual fund, and then you start with major gift activity, and then you start with ultimate gifts and large gifts. Well, we didn't have the basics. You know, I always remember I went to go meet with Ruth Doyle in the law school about improving her publications to say, you know, Ruth, we really can't do more fundraising. The law school, and dear Ruth, who I loved, and my, she was friends of my parents and so on, was putting out something that looked like a PTA newsletter, and I had to be very tactful, which I was, because of course Ruth, I mean, she had been in the legislature with my uncle, you know, and but, and I was tactful and said, Ruth, can we help you, you know, do this and to help with fundraising? Mm-hmm. And I was, and God love her. And it was a wonderful time. I got to work with Ruth Doyle myself, you know, and help her improve the newsletter. But see, that was kind of related to development and that making communications better for the alumni of the law school.
And this is the Ruth Doyle who is the mother of the current Wisconsin governor.
Governor, right,
okay.
Who recently died. Record. Right. And what a wonderful woman, and who really did so much for the whole university and the state, City of Madison. But that's how people didn't know what to do with the development.
Uh-huh.
You know, even the best minds that we had. And the faculty didn't know, and we had just nothing in public relations around. And also, people were scared to put any money into it. Because, you know, the legislature would say, oh, what are you doing spending money on public relations? So part of the whole transition, you know, to raising money was from the private sector was, if you're going to do that, you really have to look like you're first class. You can't look like, you know, you're put together, you know, sending out your alumni publications on a mimeograph sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not, you don't look first class. So there was that whole transition. And our alumni, Jim Vaughn, in particular, you know, and Irv Meyer of the journal company, you know, they would show me things they'd get in the mail. And Jim Vaughn was a graduate degree was from Syracuse, and he'd show me, we should be more like this. So, you know, I worked on that. And so far as at that time, we had changed the name of the President's Club. Irv Meyer had suggested, because of the transition, when Ed Young went up to be president, we thought this is the time to make the transition. Because there was some confusion when Weaver was president. He was saying, are some of the funds in the President Club available to the president? And we said, no, this is from UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, this is a good time to change the name and make it clear that this is related to Madison. So Irv Meyer suggested the name of Baskin Hill Society.
Oh, that's where that came from.
Uh-huh. And, of course, he's great master PR mm-hmm. from the journal company. And then he had been president of the, or head of the President's Club for the first 10 years, and then Jim Vaughn became the chair. And that's kind of when I became active. So at that time also we had Paul Fuchs design the new logo for the Baskin Hill Society,
yeah.
again on a freelance basis. And that logo lasted, I don't know, 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And we were going to redo it in about the last 5 years, but they finally did redo it now.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, that's how good his designs are. They mm-hmm. really lasted. Really good designs.
Mm-hmm.
And we used that material and that embossing and that kind of thing. And he really did a wonderful job. But so there were some really fundamental things that we were doing that were set in motion at that particular time that just have lasted. And I guess that is a very satisfying thing. And then the other thing we did, okay, so setting the marketing plan in place was very important. And part of it also was working with the Alumni Association. And there was a tension, I think, between the Alumni Association and the Foundation, and particularly Arlie Mux, and then there was the Wisconsin Singers, because Irv Shane didn't like the Wisconsin Singers because they weren't really representing the School of Music and all kinds of little politics, but because they were not classical and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But Arlie likes to promote more the athletics and so on instead of the academics.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people we wanted to talk to were interested in the academics. And of course, that's what they gave their money to. That's what we were giving money to. And what was ironic was here Bob Rennebaum, who'd been captain of the UW football team, he was the one to say, of course, the foundation must highlight the academics, you know. And he loved the football. He loved the sports and mm-hmm. all that. But he knew that we had to focus on the academics.
Mm-hmm.
So the Baskin Hill Society, when part of under my watch and what Bob encouraged me to do, Bob loved the Baskin Hill Society. That was... He was so happy when I came because that was what he did. That was what he was doing, he and the secretary. So we worked together and did programming, Bob and I and this secretary. And we increased the programming at the fall meeting. And excuse me, let me take a drink here. Okay. And so we started doing all of these, launching all these academic programs, and started to do really faculty lectures and having our members come. And really, in a way, the Bascom Hill Society got a bigger reputation and identity than the foundation, in a way, because of these programs. They were in Madison, and then we started to do them in other locations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very well received, and they were kind of our physical and presence out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the relations with Alumni Association, I think, developed into a good one because of Gail Langer. And then Irv appointed a committee of three people, Irv and, you know, and then he asked Bob for a representative, and he, which was me. So there was Harry Peterson from the Chancellor's Office and Gail Langer and me, and what we were supposed to do was coordinate all the relations between the Chancellor's Office, Alumni Association, and the Foundation. And so that people weren't tripping on each other as far as scheduling and just anything that needed to be done. And so that continued during Irv's chancellorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very helpful. And of course, it was really a wonderful opportunity for me to work with Harry Peterson, who went on to become president of a university in Montana, I believe, and Gail Langer, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from them. And I think we made strides on communication between the organizations. But the other things that that the foundation and I was responsible for was developing the idea of okay, the marketing plan. Then I also worked on new database, referred to that. I looked at what's our data, and as part of, at the same time as the campaign, we did that campaign for Wisconsin basically on 3x5 cards. I mean, it was kind of crazy, but we really had just no data. And we had an old alumni record-keeping system, and we had to download things on computer cards, and that's how we kept it.
Hmm.
It was very antiquated. And the records were kept on key punch cards. But I wanted a new record system for Bascom Hill Society members because I wanted to pull them by different codes. So I had slapped together this temporary system, working with the DO-IT office, the information technology office at the university. And, but then I just being one that, you know, nothing is out of your job description kind of mindset, I started to talk to the people in the registrar's office, and I made a good friend named Dorothy Stepien. And we said, well, let's just get together and start to talk about what could be done. And so then we talked to Bob Rennebaum, and we talked to the registrar, Tom Hoover, and they are wonderful people. Tom was a wonderful man, really far thinking, and looked at, yes, we need to do this for the benefit of the university. And so for a year and a half, Dottie and I met once a week and really did long-range planning. And she had training in that. So I learned that skill from her.
Hmm.
And what we did as part of that, we visited every dean, and then we visited every single alumni activity in the schools and college to talk about what their data needs were. And again, that was building the idea that the foundation was of service to the units. And also, just as I should have mentioned, that to start this out, that my responsibility, if you call, was faculty relations, one of my things, mm-hmm. one of my responsibilities. And I had seen that the different units, yes, we were having this campaign, but the different units around the campus were kind of quiet kind of during the campaign, but they were all talking to the other colleagues at different universities, and they were seeing that these different universities were doing development. And why aren't we? And what is our development office or foundation doing for them? And let's hire a fundraiser like Michigan or like Berkeley or private schools or so on. Mm-hmm. And so this going out, and already when I was doing little campaigns in different schools or colleges, let's say Ag Econ had an anniversary, so I was working with it. And different, I was hearing this already because I was on the front end of that. Mm-hmm. But then when I went out with Dottie and we were interviewing all of them in an organized fashion for the chancellor's office, you know, I was really hearing this. But how did we get to the point to do the organized study? Well, I'd been having these conversations with Dottie about the need for the base, the database, but I had these conversations with the faculty mm-hmm. and the deans. So I talked and talked to Bob about it, and I had said, Bob, I'm really afraid that we are just going to lose the whole ball game here. Is that, you know, at Michigan State, the foundation is just a shell. They just receive money. The whole development operation is a part of the university. That all the employees of, they are all employees of the university, the development people. And I said, is that the vision of the foundation that you have? No, that's not the vision of the foundation. The vision of the foundation is to have the fundraising go through the foundation. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, we need to do something about this. And there are other models where the foundation is just, you know, the shell. Mm-hmm. And that, then, you know, Michigan has a different structure. But you see, Bob had been sending me around. He knew the structure too because he went to all these meetings and he had been president of the American Alumni Association, so he knew what was up. And that was one of the reasons he had hired me, and he'd encouraged me and to be ambitious and to do all these things. And he'd also hired Tim. And Tim was very aggressive and out there talking to people and really kind of, I was more the inside person, Tim was the outside person. Mm-hmm. And he was ambitious for the foundation. Bob was. And so was I, and so was Tim. And so he encouraged us. So I knew Bob wasn't thinking of us as a shell. Mm-hmm. So I knew his answer. And then I said, do you mind if I just go talk to Irv about it, this? See what he says. And I could have gone with Bob, too. But we had such a good relationships that, I mean, Bob and I, that he felt, no, you know, you go and talk to Irv. Because we had had other meetings with Irv mm-hmm. ourselves. He said, you just go talk to Irv and see what he says. Well, so I just went and had a meeting with Irv and said, Irv, this is the situation. And, you know, I had this conversation with Tom Hoover and Daddy Stepien. And he said, Irv said, you know, this is why Irv was so brilliant as chancellor. Irv says, if you have the data, you have the control. Go and get this done, you know. Huh. That's it.
In that one meeting?
Yeah. He knew.
Oh. And is this the mid-80s or early 80s?
It was in 19... it was before the report we did is it was about 1979 when we started, but the report, I actually found the report, and it's the report is 1980, July 18th, 1980.
Okay.
And so we issued a formal report to Earth, and we, you know, had an appendices where we had different things quoted, and then we had everyone's, you know, every dean, you know, what they said, and I mean, it's a very official report.
Mm-hmm.
And then in it, we recommended this centralized data system and what would be included. And so this was kind of the major report that centralized the data, the alumni record system at the university. And then there was a subsequent report that I did a couple of years later just on more on advancement for Earth, that he really needed to look at consolidating advancement at the university more. And eventually he did more with that in terms of giving more power to Linda Weimer's position and so on. But I always just enjoyed, you know, being in that position, being an advisor. It was a wonderful privilege to be able to help the university that way.
This is side 2, tape 4, Martha Taylor.
So the RAR system, then the advancement, the next advancement paper. Then the next thing I think I did was work on the policy for the school and college development program. And the first, that was again in 1980. Kind of 1980 was the conclusion of the campaign. And so just as we are now concluding a campaign, every campaign you kind of have to reshuffle things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the kind of pre-campaign you have to reshuffle things. And then you have the period of the campaign and then afterwards you have to reshuffle things. So we knew we had to do something to meet the needs of these schools or colleges. And so I always had felt, okay, we have to do something for the schools and colleges, but then we have to come up with something really dynamic for the central administration.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we did the first, and what I did, again, I was really blessed with Irv and Bob's backing, and I went around and went to two or three different institutions, including pretty much Big Ten and Berkeley in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce Flessner, who's a great friend in the profession, was at Minnesota then. And he had some very good thoughts. And also Michigan State, they had some good policies. And I looked at, in Berkeley, I looked at the different policies that everyone had, and so I put together a draft policy of how the funding should be set up and how the fundraising permissions should go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put together a draft, and basically they said, yeah, this looks great.
Hmm.
So, and then I put together some drafts of forms, but people never really used the forms. Maybe a couple times they did, but they just knew this is the way it should be done. In other words, if you're going to do a campaign, you need to go through your dean and you need to go through the chancellor and then it goes through the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just go out willy-nilly with a campaign. But, you know, that was, at that particular time, that was, you know, people didn't know that. People just thought, oh, let's just make up an idea to, you know, build a building or, you know, have a professorship or do whatever. And go out and say we're going to do it and raise a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
And now we laugh about this and say, well, of course, to do a campaign of any kind, you need to get your dean's approval. You need, if it's big enough, it needs to go to the chancellor. and so on. Though all those things are in place now, but not then.
Interesting.
Not then at all. And now if, you know, projects are small enough, they're just taken care of, you know, at the dean's level. Mm-hmm. But if they're big enough, they certainly are bumped up to the chancellor. So at that time, no, people thought they just had a given right to go out and talk to anybody at any time. So maybe some of them still do. I don't know. But I think people understand the need to coordinate now because it's such big business.
Yeah.
And that everyone needs to say, well, who is talking to whom at what time? And so we were constantly talking to people, you know, everybody, you can't all go to Oscar Mayer, our biggest corporation in town, at one time. And plus, corporations are only, you know, 10% of the givers. It's individuals who give 90% of the money. Mm-hmm. These basic kind of things. So some of it was talking to the faculty and the basic education about development. Of course, that still goes on all the time. But so to me, developing the basic policies on the school and college program was a great contribution, but that only would have happened if that only happened because Irv Shane said, yes, we should do it, and Bob Brennenbaum said, yes, we should do it. I mean, yes, I was the one to go out and get the information and write the policy, but And I was the one on the front line screaming, saying we needed the policy. But that's what I was there for. Mm-hmm. And we were a team. That was my job, to tell them what was going on, you know, mm-hmm. to communicate with them and to tell them. So when we rolled the policy out, Irv asked me to, you know, come to the dean's meeting, and Bob was there, and then I made the presentation about the new policy, and it was a very nice honor. He asked me to do that. And then I had a little, you know, overhead of the pyramid of building the alumni, you know, with the publications at the bottom and the mm-hmm. alumni and the whole thing, and, you know, and the new policies and what we were going to be doing. And then I think the difficult thing was, you know, delivering, you know, on all this. And then I think we hired at that point a publications person, Jeff Ignacek. And we had
meeting the foundation.
Yeah. And he reported to me. And then we had 11 direct mail pieces to do for the 11 schools and colleges that year in 1980 because we were going to start annual giving programs for them. We had no telephone at that time. So, that was kind of a nightmare. And we did a little brochure on each one. So we had 11 with just two people, me and Jeff. So
wow.
It was like crazy. Why did we ever do that? I don't know. That was nuts. But I think that was one of the things that was it's always my downfall, is my fault, was is one of my great failings is trying to overachieve, you know, and having my expectations way too high.
Uh-huh.
And now that I'm older, I'm just much better on saying, this is not possible.
But don't you think it's a function of age? I mean, it's not just who you are.
Yes.
I mean, I know you're ambitious and visionary, but you were also what? 32, 35,
30? It was absolutely nuts that I was so young with so much responsibility. And
yes.
I look at that and I think, oh my gosh, I can't believe that Irv and Bob let me have all that responsibility and that they let me speak to all these groups and do all these things. And it's a miracle that I made a lot of mistakes. Especially in supervising people later on. But I didn't make any mistakes relative to a person that age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now I look at that and I say, these young people in our office with, we hadn't even bought a house yet. I mean, how can you make any decisions when you haven't even bought a house, you mm-hmm. know?
Exactly.
It's amazing, mm-hmm. you know, so I was very lucky. But I worked really, really hard and put in a lot of hours too, mm-hmm. and that helped. And I did, Bob was right there all the time for mentoring me, and Tim too was right there too. We did a lot of work. I traveled a lot with Tim. I also was doing at the same time as that. We were doing, then after the campaign, the financial planning seminars all around the country. So we were doing brochures for that. Tim launched the financial planning seminars all around the country as a follow-up to the campaign because he wanted to keep up the geographic activity. Oh. So he set up kind of a really neat idea of getting kind of financial people and then local chairs in the community to kind of sponsor these things at clubs and so on. Mm-hmm. And we invited Bascom Hill Society members. And I did those brochures all for every single one and with Jeff. I mean, we were cranking out work. I mean, mm-hmm. we'd have to work, I'd say, most weekends and during the school year. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an incredible
right.
schedule. Because we had, you know, all those seminars and then we had this annual giving thing for the mm-hmm. schools and colleges. And that was good. To get that started, but it kind of was, you gotta do this to raise the funds in order to justify more staff.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the same time though, the university, we're trying to build up the university's PR. Again, I mentioned that. And a little bit before, around, I don't know if it was 78, 79, in there, too, as part of that campaign period too, one of the things that, I'd wanted to do as part of that, and Fred Winding had been doing the honor roll in the annual report, and that was always a very cumbersome thing with all listing of all the names, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And one of the things we had been discussing at our little morning coffee hours was the problem that the bulk of the alumni were not getting any communications from the university. That, you see, all they were getting with the people who joined the Alumni Association were getting communications.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. They were getting the Alumni Magazine. But the rest of the alumni were getting nothing.
Mm.
So let's say of the, at that time, 200,000 alumni, let's say 35, 40,000 were getting them. And no one else was getting anything except for they would get, you know, one annual solicitation. Well, that doesn't really inspire giving, does it?
No.
There's no communication about what's going on at the university or anything. So we were talking about it, and basically the bottom line of the whole thing was in all these different various conversations with Bob and Herb and Art Hovey's office. Is I talked Art Hovey's office into, and John Gruber in particular, I talked Art Hovey into this a new publication by a bunch of committee meetings and so on. That would be a tabloid that would be mailed to all alumni. I mean, we all thought this was a good idea, but it was really foundation driven because we needed to have informed alumni to be givers. And of course, the Alumni Association wanted this so they get more members too. But there was a danger, you know, is this going to compete with the magazine, blah, blah, blah. But there wasn't, because we wanted them to get members. So, and then we also thought we'd fold in the honor roll in the tabloid, too, once a year. Okay. So that our annual report could be clean and really nice without all those list of names, and it could be more just a nice report.
Mm-hmm.
So, and because by that time I'd taken over the annual report, too. And
sure. Well, you would under communication.
Yeah. So then we had this meeting. Carol Maroney, who was head of the medical school communications at that time. She's now retired. But she was a member of our little committee of like six or seven. everybody at the foundation used to give me grief about all these committees I'd have. But I was trying to get consensus from the campus and involvement and that kind of thing. But Carol Maroney at a meeting, we were talking about what should we call it. And Carol Maroney says, let's call it On Wisconsin.
Oh, is that where that comes from?
Yes. Yes. I did not make it up. John Gruber did not. Nobody. Carol Maroney made it up. She said, let's call it On Wisconsin. Everybody goes, yes, it's perfect. Of course. That's wonderful. Yeah. So that's how the publication On Wisconsin was born. And it was this big tabloid, and it had news about the campus and all this. And John Gruber really looked to me and the foundation, what articles did we want to have in it? But we paid for the thing, and we paid for the mailing and the production of the whole thing. And then it was designed by Paul Fuchs up in communications.
Oh, yeah,
and then Norm Lemberg was the photographer, and also Dale Brown a little bit from photo media. And so that's when I got acquainted with those people. But so we got a lot of, you know, foundation information going out to alumni. I mean, subtle, but things like that we wanted about faculty, about, you know, this kind of thing. And then we'd coordinate, John would coordinate with Tom Murphy, of WAA editor of the Alumnus magazine. Mm-hmm. And Tom was a lovely guy. We included him in everything. Wonderful man. I think it worked. So I think the first article we include the honor roll in was really fun. We had the marching band collage, you know. That was when Mike LaCrone, I always say, Mike, I'm the one that first gave you national exposure, you know, because I had said, let's do the marching band as a collage throughout the honor roll, you know, because that was about the first time they were doing the fifth quarter, you know.
Oh, really? Is that when that started?
Yeah, they did a long time ago, you know. And so we had these pictures of them doing the fifth quarter and stuff throughout the On Wisconsin and the honor roll and all these funny poses. And that went to the whole list of the 200,000 alumni all over the country. And it is the first time the whole alumni body was exposed to the marching band did a fifth quarter, you know. And it was great. I mean, it was a wonderful thing. It's a great thing for the band, too.
Well, but that is comparable to the RAR system in terms of management of the alumni population of the university.
Yeah.
Which has been so critical. It's the central factor in the fundraising success that the foundation has had.
Yeah, yeah. So there are all these at that time. That's why it was such an interesting time, fascinating time, because we were building the building blocks.
Yes.
For the program now.
And yes, you were.
Yeah. And that we were putting them all in place. And so the constituency program, the RAR system, the marketing program, and then we developed the telefund. That was the next thing, the telefund marketing, because Indiana had started telefund in the Big Ten. And so I flew down to Indiana, I looked at their telefund, they invited all the Big Ten colleagues. Again, we were a tight-knit group in the Big Ten, and we shared everything really well. We still do, but it was such a small group then, and and so I went down, spent a couple of days, and I said, yeah, we got to do this. But that was an uphill battle, I think I mentioned. That was the most difficult sell I had to the board as far as doing it, because it's such a high cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, I hired Larry Hensley to do that and had to oversee that. But that was very tough because of the operations with it. And
where was the foundation housed at that time?
Oh, that's when we started to have to splinter our offices. We were still in the Wisconsin Center. We needed to get more space in a different space. And that wasn't my area. And I wish someone had been working on that more quickly. But eventually, of course, we went to the Varex building. But We were in the Wisconsin Center. I don't know if somebody just didn't want us to expand, but University Club was, we got that space because I was having lunch with Fan Taylor, and she said, do you know anyone who could take over our offices and pay some money for rent? I said, yeah, us. We're looking for space. So that's how that happened. And so we took over the second floor of the University Club, and we started to put all of our constituency people there in our telefund.
Okay.
So then by that time, Jeff Ignacet had left, and we hired Molly Buckley, and then the constituency people all were over there, college and school people. And then I had an office there and over at the Wisconsin Center, which was crazy. But and then we had another office for a while over on in 905 University Avenue. Bob had found us that because we had, you know, owned that for a while. Mm. We had actually owned that building. Because Bob and John were always dealing with a lot of our properties too, you know. I mean, we owned Hilldale for a long time. And then at that time, John and Bob were also building the golf course, you know. Mm-hmm. They were preoccupied with that project. I mean, we did so many things hands-on, you know. Mm-hmm. Tim was running around talking to people all around the country and about deferred gifts, and we had that financial quarterly magazine, mm-hmm. or newsletter with a response mechanism, and we had to pump that out for him, our staff, and then he got all the leads and were following up with that. And he was actively doing that, doing a very good job at it. But so I think you know, it was hard being scattered, but that was a little bit later before we started really getting staff. But then we also started research. We hired one research person while we were still at the Wisconsin Center, and had them doing, you know, research on people. Mm-hmm. So that was started at the same time. There were a lot of things started. The other thing I want to mention was the University Relations Grant. That was the other thing that was started at that time. I mentioned On Wisconsin, but the On Wisconsin Grant was part of, and I made up the idea of the University Relations Grant. And when Sandy Wilcox first came here in 1988, he was appalled that we had this thing called the University Relations Grant. But of course, as later, it took him about 5 years, and he calmed down on many things, and when he started to understand why we did things the way we did. Mm-hmm. But when I came to the foundation, what happened is Art Hovey, who worked for Irv Shane in charge of the communications office in Baskin, they would like they'd have a special need for a publication, like an anniversary publication, or the one that comes to mind is E.B. Fred had written a kind of a nice publication called Seeing the UW Today, and it was kind of a nice little piece that he had written about different historical sites around the university.
Oh.
It was a nice piece that you could give to donors, yeah. and just to have. Well, but it's kind of something that you're going to be short in your regular budget for. Well, Art would kind of go to Bob and say, Bob, do you think you can fund this? And Bob would say, yeah, that's a great idea. But then they would farm out the graphics and the printing. And it always disappointed the staff who I'd become friends with up on Baskin. Because here was the plum piece, the one that they could really work on. It had private money with a larger price tag than the state dollars, mm-hmm. and something they could really show off their talents on and do a beautiful job for the university as a giveaway piece. And so they were always so disappointed that you know, here they could have done a beautiful job on this piece, and why was it that this wasn't more cohesively done with a plan? Mm-hmm. And also then from Bob's viewpoint, it was kind of like, well, it'd be nice kind of if I knew what was coming down from Bascom so I could budget for it, kind of thing. So, and then I went to Art and I said, well, Art, you know, I think the foundation would be willing to support, you know, more of these things. But, you know, if we planned ahead. And so everybody was happy. It was just a matter of nobody had really sat down and talked. And so Jack Newman, who was head of news service, said, you know, it's kind of amazing. Nobody from the foundation has ever really had these conversations with us before. And so it was fun, you know, just talking.
Indeed.
Just talk. All it was just talking to people. And so one of the needs of the campus was, for example, a fact sheet about the campus. That there were just little fact sheets, you unfolded them, and you gave them out at Founders Days. You gave them to important donors. And so we funded that. And they did all the work and consulted with us on what, you know, was needed. But we funded that. And then we added things like we sent some of the staff to conferences because they didn't have the budget. You know, as a perk for doing all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they needed to do that. They didn't have the budget. That's an area of the university. The budget was always cut. You know,
sure.
Communications. Terrible. Yeah. That was terribly needed for our operation. Now, today, we started that budget. So in the On Wisconsin budget, the tabloid, that budget was put in, the regular budget that went to all the alumni. If we put our honor roll in, we paid for that part out of foundation money. But the other key part of this whole thing was money, if you transfer money to the university, it appears on our record as transfers to and for the university. It doesn't appear as administrative expenses to the university, to the foundation. Big difference.
Indeed.
Big difference. So you know, you have to be careful on, you know, who you charge what. But some of these things that we had been paying for ourselves out of foundation funds were legitimate university expenses. So I made that case to Bob, and he said, yeah, absolutely, this is much better to do this as it's a university project. Now, what's happened now is the university relations grant, now here, how many years later, 25 years later, is something like, I don't know, $2.2 million.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
And of course, over the years, my job description, of course, has changed, and now I'm in major in planned gifts and spend all my time doing that and aren't responsible for these areas anymore. But that concept of the funding of the On Wisconsin tabloid, the On Wisconsin tabloid was taken then, and with the staff, which was wonderful, with the different changes of staff, and all over Gail retired, of course, and it was merged with the Wisconsin Alumnus Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So the tabloid and the magazine were merged so that the On Wisconsin was a magazine, beautiful, then that was upgraded, sent to all alumni, and then there was an insert just for the members.
Right.
Okay. And then LNS put an insert in it to LNS.
Mm-hmm.
And in color, you know, first class, as our institution is, the way that it should be. And now every single unit around the campus has a first-class alumnus magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law school, the business school, they're all in color. They're all 8.5 by 11. But when we started, they were just pitiful. And we had to educate the deans about why should they spend money. I mean, I remember having meetings with John Palmer, one of the most brilliant and lovely people, about
School of Education.
And the first time, and these deans would get mad at me. You know, this little chirpy woman, but I was very nice to them, but it was kind of like, I said, when we, in 1980, we did our first direct mail mailing, I mentioned that, about, to the School of Education. Sent it out. Dear School of Ed grad, we had a little brochure about the School of Ed, signed by the dean, blah, blah, blah. Please give, blah, blah, blah. You know, the results come in, blah, blah, blah. And the expenses, of course, are charged to the School of Ed for whatever comes in. He gets this report, and I get this furious phone call about, well, I didn't know we were going to charge for these expenses. I mean, it was absolutely clear. You know, expenses are charged to them. I mean, I would have spent that money somewhere else. I mean, after all the preparation, in front of all the deans, that the constituency fundraising programs, the out-of-pocket expenses will be incurred by the schools or colleges, and just doesn't know that you have to invest. Mm-hmm. And of course, John came around to it and figured it out very well. But, you know, there were those two or three and a couple of deanships, you know, where we were making every time there's a dean change, you have the job description of the dean having a larger and larger percentage of their time being spent on fundraising.
Yes.
Over this period of time. Mm-hmm. And when I came in, there was, it was 0%. So, I mean, it was a shock, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was, we had to do it gently, and we were just starting. We were just starting from zero. But they all knew, and Dave Cronin in particular, he really knew, and he was ready to invest, for example. He was very good. But it was interesting. But they would get mad because, you know, the foundation wanted to control access to prospects and different kinds of things. And when we weren't staffed to meet their needs, and I think that was difficult. Mm-hmm. That was difficult. But I think I've covered, I think, the main things that were accomplished that I feel that, you know, were the things during that period that were significant, those building blocks that I was involved with during that particular time when I was in management at the foundation. And they were very creative times. And again, they were a time when I was in management because of Bob Rennebaum and Irv Shane. And then I knew with the hiring of all these people, though.
This is tape 5, side 1 of the continuing interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 21st, 2006. Martha, you were commenting about that very creative period in the 1980s and construction of the building blocks that the hundreds of millions of dollars in the 1990s rest upon.
Yes, it was. It was a wonderful period of time, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the personalities. First, I mentioned some of the people, you know, the foundation staff, but some of the foundation board members were particularly great people and helped with this and understood this. And there were people like Warren Knowles, who was on our board, and you know, he understood, of course, the vision of the university. And when he had been governor too, he had been so supportive of the university. But he led the Tony Carreri fund drive for the cancer center, and you know, Bob assigned me to staff him on that. And what a great honor to do that. And then he became aware of how inadequate our records were when I was working with him on that. And so then he became a big advocate for, you know, trying to upgrade our record system. But, of course, we also looked at, it's good old-fashioned visits for something like Tony Carreri campaigns. So, you know, getting back to campaigning and assigning people, it was helping Warren, you know, getting people to go visit people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember on that one, I went to this jeweler that Tony had treated in Chicago. And it was just a wonderful visit with this man. And I went way up into his, you know, his building. It was one of those creaky buildings in Chicago on the third floor, and just made this wonderful visit. And it's just all these memories with these interesting people that you meet early on, and
mm-hmm.
how, you know, even though I only met Tony once, I had met him. He was one of our chairs, the medical school chair, during the faculty staff campaign.
Oh.
During the campaign for Wisconsin. Yeah. And he was just a vibrant guy. But one of these stars, you know, on our faculty. So, and of course, I remember fondly Warren, and so many things are named for him, and well-deserved. Then, of course, Catherine Clary was on our board. And, oh, and what a stately woman and an inspiration. And and as a woman, you know, she was an inspiration.
And she was with Northwestern Mutual then?
Yeah. And she, of course, she was always one. And, oh, and I had too taken Dress for Success very seriously too. And she was one too. I mean, we talked about that in the women's restroom.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying, and I was saying, well, what advice do you have for me? She said, never wear red in the meetings. You know, always look, you know, don't wear bright colors when you go to these men's meetings, you know. Very businesslike. And I thought that was very good advice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, I mean, and I think now you could probably get away with it, but, you know, always look very much like in your gray suit and very, you know, your power suit is what she was saying. Mm-hmm. And that wording came along much later. But, of course, she was always very lovely and charming, but very businesslike. But very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have our little chats in the women's room, and I always appreciated that very much. And, of course, later, Jean Biddick joined the board, and she was great, but not until a little bit later. Gordon Walker. Gordy was on the Regents, and he was from Racine, and he always had a twinkle in his eye. And he had been to recruit Weaver to be president. And, oh, he was so supportive of the staff, all of us. And he had, an 80th birthday. This was years later. But we all went down to Racine for that party. And he invited all of us, you know, all of the core people, you know, John, Fred, Bob, me, Tim. And because we just loved him so much. He was just such a wonderful man. And he, politically, he was conservative. And I know he served on the Regents during the Vietnam War when I was out probably protesting and taking a walk up for the Cambodia bombings. But that doesn't matter. You know, I loved him dearly. He never knew any of that. But he was very worried about the university's relations with the legislature and all that during that time. And, you know, he was a wonderful man. Just devoted to the institution and volunteered a lot for the foundation. He was one of my favorite people. Don Slichter, of course, he was the son of Charles of Wharf fame.
Uh-huh.
And Don was with Northwest Mutual. And his daughter was married to John Pike, who was head of Wharf. But Don had been a student of my grandfather's in chemical engineering, and so we had a special friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And he, too, had a twinkle in his eye, and he would invite me to these class of 23 chemical engineers who every time they met, they had to come up with some other Bucky paraphernalia on, you know, like, they had spats, and then they'd have a handkerchief with a W on it and a hat, and, you know, and they just were characters. And they'd all done very well. But Don had a particularly good insight into policy about the foundation. And I think it was because maybe working in the insurance industry, being aware of Wharf, you know, I'd he was very sensitive and interested in the policy issues, you know, for the long term. So he was very interested in, you know, some of these issues we were bringing up about, you know, that the foundation should be the fundraising arm and not have the development operation out in the schools and colleges. And that the fact that it was very important to have the fundraising at the foundation because you don't want to have all those gift records being mucked around by the legislature. Mm-hmm. And you want to have it separate. You know, it's these policy issues like that. I mean,
that's very important.
It's very critical.
It's more important today than it. More important today, isn't it, Martha, than even back then?
Absolutely. It's more important today than ever. And also the investment ease. Because the investments of the foundation, even then, relatively, were still very large for the university. And mm-hmm. they had the Wharf investments, then you had the Regents investments, the UW Foundation, and the university wanted to grow the UW Foundation investments because that meant flexibility. So the area of, you know, John Felt's operation was very important to keep the money or grow the endowments and funnel the gift money to the foundation because of the flexibility in the management. And again, that was a big sales point we had with the schools and colleges, is they didn't want to tie up their money in 133 accounts or whatever.
Right.
Because it was just more difficult to manage that money. And of course now our endowment is something like $2.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And we can manage it, we can move funds around, we can just be a lot more flexible. And these people on our board, you see, they understood this, you know, the Don Slifters, then we had also Les Clemens, he was an attorney, he understood a lot of the legal issues. We relied on him for that very much because we didn't have any attorneys on the staff at that time. We relied on Les a lot. We did have Vern Howard as our attorney, but we relied a lot on volunteers.
Huh.
Another, Tony DiLorenzo, he was vice president of General Motors, and Tony was a terrific guy.
I don't know that name.
Yeah, Tony, a character, and just wonderful guy, great on public relations. That's what his background was, journalism, public relations. So we would always have a lot in common at the board meetings. And because, you know, I was asking his advice on the communications and on the centralization issues and, you know, the marketing and the annual report messages. And so after every annual report, you know, he'd write me a note and say, that was great theme or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. But then he became the chairman of the board of the foundation, too. And, you know, and these guys, they and Bob always took care of me so far as my raises. You know, they were really very generous with me, you know.
And you felt respected, even though you were one of the few women.
Oh, I did.
Only woman.
I was the only woman professional. And after 3 years, I was promoted to associate director. And then there was a kind of a restructuring. I don't know if it was maybe within 2 years or 3 years after that they made the associate directors vice presidents. And so Bob didn't have to make me vice president, but he did. Because I did have a lot of responsibility at that time. I had all these people reporting to me and I had communications and so on. Another person is Harlan Nichols. Harlan was from Madison, and he served on the foundation, I think, the longest of anybody on the board. But he was treasurer. Almost from, 55. I think he was on the committee that hired Bob, practically. But he and Bob, there are stories about Bob and he when they came, was that the foundation's bank accounts were in all these different banks because they didn't want to choose one because they wanted to kind of make everybody happy.
Uh-oh.
Which is, of course, terrible for, you know, business efficiency and earning interest and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so Harlan and Bob, you know, consolidated the funds and then they started to invest them. And, you know, Bob was the sole person. He was the only staff person for a long time, for a long time. And so Bob, actually, Bob and Harlan Nichols, who was a banker, had, they invested the money, you know. So Bob learned how to invest money on his own. Bob's background was ag, and he was actually in sales, and and that was his background. And then Harlan Nichols had been banking, and so, but Bob learned investments and how to invest the foundation's money, and that's when it was started. So consolidating the assets. So yeah, so yeah, and Bob was just one of those myths out there. Great fixtures. But so he gathered these wonderful people who just dearly loved the university. And, of course, one of the criteria was they gave money as well. The Becker family, George and Norm of Fond du Lac, also were on the board, highly respected. George was with a company in Fond du Lac, and Norm was a physician. Norm became our president and was our membership chair for years. But it wasn't, you know, a lot of it, we did go out and recruit people from CEO positions and so on. But, you know, because we had such a small staff, you and the terms are still about 12 years. You know, there was low turnover. And I think that, that's good in that you have stability, but it's bad in that you can't open it up to a lot of new people. Mm-hmm. And we still have that problem. I think we've tried to recruit, you know, some new high-flying CEOs who have a lot of potential with changing times. And, of course, Wharf has put on a lot of the top CEOs on their board. But in general, I think the quality of the board members has always been high. But of course, in when I came on the board, it was such a close, small family that it was a different type of a feeling. Mm-hmm. Now the board has been enlarged so much. Mm-hmm. We used to meet in the old Milwaukee club of Irv Meyer's on the third floor. It was a beautiful, it's a beautiful old club across from Pfister.
Oh, that red brick building?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Beautiful old historic building mm-hmm. that was Irv Meyer's favorite place. And then we went to the university club. And we all used to drive over together. And we always went, all of us, to the investment committee meetings. So I learned all about investments that way. And, of course, I didn't sell my Cisco stock at the peak, unfortunately. Oh, well. I knew to buy it, though, but didn't sell it at the top. Uh-huh. But you know, now, of course, they don't allow the staff, except for the investment staff, to sit in on the investment meeting because there's too many people. You know, and they don't allow all of the staff to go to the winter board meeting because there's too many people, too expensive. And, you know, so that's what happens when you get big, and it's bound to happen. Mm-hmm. But, so there are good and bad things about being small, being big. But it was a small community. A little bit more about being small. Because we were so small, everybody had to do everything, of course. And so everybody had to work Bascom Hill Society events, for example. And this week, of course, John Felt is retiring after all these years.
Oh, is he?
Shock. I know. I don't know what life is going to be like without John. And with his sense of humor, which sometimes kind of I wondered about, but you just had to get used to it. And it is really funny. And he's just like a rock, you know, so good in working with donors. But he would be the one, you know, to always give out the name tags. I mean, he'd be right there. He'd be giving out name tags. And Fred would be escorting somebody, some elderly person around. I mean, mm-hmm. they'd be working it as much as anybody else. I mean, everybody, all the secretaries and all the professionals had to work every single Bascom Hill Society event.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any question about it. Of course, nowadays it's kind of like, who wants to work this event? I mean, there isn't the ownership in the Bascom Hill Society at all, which is kind of like our central activity. Then it was our only activity, you know. And then what we did was we were trying to build the school and college programs. You know, we were trying to interest the schools or colleges in doing something like that, believe it or not. And so what we came up with this idea of, let's feature the College of Letters and Science at this Bascom Hill Society. I mean, I started to do two meetings, one in June and one in the fall, continue the fall meeting, which we'd always had, which Bob had always had in fall meeting. But then I added a June meeting. And we featured a school or college.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's how we kind of got the schools or college into the fold. Again, the idea the foundation is providing a service, we're your team, you know, and then also to get them to start to sit down, identify donors, to invite the donors to come, get the dean engaged, and this kind of activity, and have tables reserved. This was kind of the first to start them to think about having events for their alumni.
Bascom Hill Society for a long time was a really big deal, wasn't it?
Oh, it was huge.
Not just for the foundation, but for donors. I mean, it was a landmark event, wasn't it? You know, they looked forward to it. It was both a social, it was an academic university event, but it was also a prestigious social event, wasn't it? It was.
And, of course, Bob wanted it to be that way. And then when Sandy Wilcox came, he didn't want it to be that way. So that's why it changed. And he just felt awkward with it. And he wasn't used to it that way. Stanford didn't have it where Sandy came from. And so he didn't understand it. And so that was just an adjustment, you know, as one of many we had to make. But that's just the way it goes. And, you know, but so it was coming
from...
But for
history, it's important to remember... What it was, Martha.
It was, absolutely. And still it's important, and people get together. And there's still the fall event, and we still have the luncheons in Madison. But, yes, when Bob Rennbaum was president, and even a little bit going into Sandy's first years, it was the prestigious thing to go to in Madison.
Yes.
And it was the premier activity the university had. The university itself was doing no events for donors or alumni or anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were having the Founders Day dinners. And there was a Founders Day dinner in Madison. But so far as a more, a dressier kind of occasion that was fancy, it was the Bascom Hill Society meetings. And where we had... You know, classical music, we had a different venue,
mm-hmm.
we had interesting speakers, we had themes,
mm-hmm.
we had a very nice invitation, we had nice flower arrangements, you know, this kind of thing. This
and at that time, how much did you have to give to become a member?
In the beginning, it was $10,000, and then it was raised to $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is, and it probably should be raised again, but I don't think it will be.
Mm-hmm. But during the 80s, it was $10,000.
Yeah.
A one-time $10,000
gift? No, payable over a few years. But then it was, I forget when it was raised, though. It was raised maybe 85. I mean, it was to 25.
No, it was raised after I came to the foundation.
Oh, was it? Okay.
In the early 90s.
Oh, was it? Okay. So it was 90. Okay. See, I'm glad you remembered that. I forget.
I remember. You told me. You know,
I forget.
One day I was going to have lunch with Terry Howler. You said to me,
okay.
Terry is not a member yet. Why don't you tell him he can get in now before it's raised?
I remember. That's good. I remember.
I remember that quite clearly. That's why I know. But
that's good you remember, Bob, because I don't remember when we raised it.
Anyway.
I should have these things memorized, you know. But, okay, so it was early 90s. Good thing to know that. But we did. We need to. But, you see, look at this now. We need to look at raising it again, probably.
Probably.
We, you know, just because of inflation. In the beginning, of course, you know, now there's something like 5,000 members. I mean, because, again, you get so many members.
Right.
But
because you knew most of them at one point, didn't you,
yes,
Martha?
Yes. When I came, there were about 100 members, you know. And, of course, Jim Vaughn was chair for the first 10 years. We had so much fun. Jim and Kay Vaughn. Oh, Kay Vaughn, wonderful person. And Jim, such a lively person. And I mentioned him when he talked about his publications. But Jim was vice president of Square D Company.
Oh, right.
And I'd visit them in Chicago. I'd visit them in Milwaukee and get them their advice. We'd meet often in Madison, Jim and I, about the strategy about Bascom Hill Society.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also had a thing called the Bascom Hill Society Executive Committee, where we would involve alumni and you know, members, and we had wonderful people on that. Mark Kirchensteiner from Mount Horeb, Carlton Holstrom from New York,
mm-hmm.
Bud and Roxy Heise from Milwaukee, the DeSimones from Kenosha. Yeah, wonderful and very generous donors who would advise us on different events, on marketing, on levels, on insurance gifts, different aspects of the society that we had. And it was a very good committee for involving new people and also involving past board members, too. So some of our past board members were on that committee, and mm-hmm. that was a privilege to work with those people. And then, of course, that's where Jim Vaughn got famous for his locomotive cheer, was the Bascom Hill Society meetings, where he got up at the end of the meetings and he loves trains, and he's a train buff, and so he leads the varsity, but then he does the cheer, and he always says it's supposed to be, you know, like a steam engine, and, you know, as you do it, it's where you build up the cheer like a steam engine, because he thinks it's too fast when we sing it at the football stadium. And now he's doing it at age 88 still.
Is he still doing it, Martha?
Yes, he was at the annual meeting just about a month ago, age 88, with his red suspenders, got up on stage and did it. It was wonderful. So those are kind of some of the memories of some of those great early people I worked with. All right, so those were the personalities and the wonderful board members that I remember. The legacy of what Bob established for the foundation is really, really important. And what he did is really establish the whole vision for the foundation and really what we do today, the whole personality of the foundation, the integrity of the foundation, the whole philosophy of the foundation, which is based on stewardship with donors. It's based on building a relationship with donors for the long haul. And those of us who were hired early on, and also the early constituency people, including the later leaders such as Walt Keough and Marion Brown, Don Gray, and so on, who had worked with him and then worked with those of us who had worked with him, it rubbed off on them, and they accepted it as, this is the foundation way. And that has continued. And I think that is a really, really important part of the legacy of Bob Branimore. But what happened, I think, was I mentioned earlier, is that Bob was a lover and not a fighter, in that we had been a small shop and we were all used to kind of doing our own thing, and he was kind of used to just having each of us go into him with our own projects. And we, other than going out to coffee, we didn't have any staff meetings. Mm-hmm. And so he wasn't really used to administering a lot of staff. We started hiring people. We hired Dave Utley, who was a wonderful guy for the law school campaign. And then, as I mentioned, we hired Marion Brown and Walt Keough, Marcy Heim. Those three people reported to me. We had athletic fundraiser Dave Spangler. He reported to Bob because of Bob's best friend was Elroy Hirsch. And I think that that was best, having the athletics report to Bob. Like, they have the medical school and you have the athletic department. They're just worlds unto themselves. But then the business school, we had a couple of people in that, engineering, and Benish and Bitter. But it became apparent that, you know, I didn't have the supervisor experience. Tim didn't have supervisor experience. And yet we were doing the best that we could. But Bob really didn't also encourage us to go get supervisor experience. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt like you just get on the job experience. And that he wasn't quite sure. We were all just so darn busy just trying to keep up with what we had started. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were kind of really just overwhelmed because, see, we had taken on all these schools and colleges, 11 schools and colleges campaigns, and we barely had time to take a breath, you know. It was pretty overwhelming. And then in the midst of that, of course, in 84, I had my first child. So it was like, I didn't have any
time. That's
right,
I forgot about your children.
And it was like, oops, I was so committed to my career and everything that and my husband was just starting his own law practice, that, you know, financially I had to go right back. And we had no, you know, accumulated sick leave or anything. There was no vacation, you know, policy. Everybody just took 2 weeks. And there was no accumulated sick leave or anything. So it was like, well, what do you do? So at any rate, I came back after 6 weeks. And that was awful. Mm-hmm. It was just terrible. So that was just a terrible thing. And I was just totally exhausted the whole time. And then I tried to breastfeed. I did breastfeed at night once for the rest of 1 year. Totally, I was exhausted. So I just thought, oh, this is no good. So I knew I just didn't want to, I mean, how much time can I spend on this? I had a young child at home. So I was talking to Bob about this, talking to Irv too, and Joel Skornicka was just finishing his time as mayor, and they were trying to figure out what is a good thing for him to do. Well, he came to the foundation in a job, vice president for administration. But it really didn't work out for Joel because he really wasn't interested in development. He didn't want to make visits with people. There wasn't enough for him to administrate. You know, we knew we needed an administrator because we were all good at what we did, but we didn't have administrative experience. We all admitted that and knew that, and we were good at other things. But I think the solution would have been better to train all of us in administration, especially train Tim and me. I think that would have been the solution, because it really didn't work, having Joel. And then what happened is it created worse problems because then he was trying to do things and then we couldn't do.
This is side two of tape 5, Martha Taylor.
Yeah, so that was unfortunate because I think he had done some good things working for Irv in administration when he had worked up there, but he just did not fit at all in the foundation. And he was encouraged to look elsewhere. It just, he worked for Chase and now the Alvian then. But it created chaos between all of us. And great unhappiness. I think that was a very, very difficult time. He was really a very negative force because he was very unhappy there. He didn't know what he was supposed to be doing, and he needed to find something that was meaningful to him to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he left, and then he went to UC Davis, and I think he was happier there. But I think that took a big toll out of us, and certainly took a big toll out of me. And I think by that time, also in 86, and I was still very close to Bob. And in 86 was a terrible year for me. My grandfather died in January, and then by that time, I miscarried twins in. At the exact day of the foundation annual meeting. So I knew, you know, stress does have something to do with miscarriages.
Uh-huh.
And then my dad died unexpectedly that August.
Oh, my God.
It was a terrible year. And my dad was 64 and he'd been well and so on. It was an aneurysm. And it was just terrible. We were on our way to a family reunion. So I just had barely, you know, recovered from grieving about my grandfather, grieving about losing his twins. And then really, the blow was my dad. And Mark was two, my son. And so at that point, I really, you know, all this stress at work, I guess I really questioned all this time I was spending at work.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was the beginnings of when I really started to move my thoughts away from where really the maternal instincts, or maybe not so much. I think one of the reasons we connected early on was when you said you left the Marshfield Clinic because you just said you wanted something else to do in your life, and you had spent 60-hour weeks, and you said you wanted to get to know your family
mm-hmm.
more, you know, and you make these decisions. But I really viewed, I said, here my dad had died a month before he retired, and, you know, here my son is 2 years old, and I'm spending all this time. So that was 86, and yet, you know, I still was working and working hard, but I really did, you know, start to look at other priorities and other things.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I became very much more interested and sensitive to, you know, women's issues. I mean, I was always interested in women's issues, but women making choices in life. You know, I got very interested in that. And so in 86, too, we were starting to get ready for another campaign. And then I think also Bob had some health problems. And, or 87, about. And 87, I think, was when we were doing a feasibility study for a new campaign. And they went out and Tim had been a priest, of course, and we had that in common, our interest in the church. But and he respected women, but it was a different relationship with women.
Mm-hmm.
It was a priest and a dominant relationship with women.
Mm-hmm.
And we had had some problems with that over time.
Uh-huh.
He'd always respected me, very much respected me, and supported me. But he definitely was always, it was always, you know, I'm up and you're down, kind mm-hmm. of a thing. But he always respected women, and I always have to say that, you know. But it just is hard to overcome your upbringing.
He cannot move beyond women being lesser.
Yeah, I...
He may respect... He does respect women.
Very much.
But it's
very much
very clear that they are always lesser.
Yeah, it's hard to overcome your upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And, but... yet, considering all of that, he was always wonderful working with women donors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he went out of his way to visit them because, he knew they had a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he gave them a lot of attention,
mm-hmm.
as any good planned giving officer should. And he was very good with them. And he was very attentive to them. And but he's good to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is. But so far as working on the staff with you, it's fine as long as he's in charge, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was going on. But, so Tim, in viewing the criteria for the feasibility study, I had to go on that aside to tell about Tim, because even though I loved him and he respected women, it was Tim who put together the people to be interviewed for the feasibility study. And what was asked was, for the feasibility study, what you're supposed to do is, during that time for a campaign, you identify what projects at the university need funding, and then you take them out to your 100 top prospects and opinion leaders, and then you test them out,
mm-hmm.
and you have them rate them, okay? And when the results came back from the feasibility study, which were reported at a board meeting, the School of Education and the School of Human Ecology rated really, really, really low. Okay. Almost non-existent. And there were jokes or comments. They said later they were jokes. There were comments made at the board meeting. Well, I don't think we should have these things in the campaign. And Jean Biddick, who is a graduate of SOHI and a very big supporter of it, said, well, of course we should have these things in the campaign. And then she asked, well, how many women were interviewed as part of the 100? 6.
Wow.
6. Well, that was the defining moment that kind of changed my life. And, I mean, that really had a big bearing on my life, because it was like, whoa. And, these were colleges that were kind of speaking to me at that time when I was dealing with a small child and these issues of work and family balance and that kind of thing. They were speaking to me and, you know, they deal with these kinds of issues. And, so right after the meeting, in the meeting room at the University Club, I said, Jean, this was terrible. She said, you go back and you call Hammond Covenant and tell them what happened. And so I did. And I called them and told them what happened. So he called.
And Hammond Covenant being?
He was the dean of School of Human Ecology.
Okay.
And Bernie Cohen, Irv had left by that time to go to Olin Company. And so Bernie Cohen was the acting chancellor, and he was at the meeting as well. And so Ham called Bernie, and Bernie said, no, Ham, we would include it in the campaign. He said, well, I just wanted to make sure, But Jean was so alarmed, she felt that we should have a meeting of some women. Because she said when we met with the 6 women, including Catherine Vaughn, who was Kay Vaughn, the wife of Jim Vaughn, who was the chairman of the board of the foundation by that time, a graduate of SOPI as well. She felt, by this time, you know, I had been at the foundation for 13 years at that time, 12, 13 years. By that time, I felt that, hey, if women, you know, I hadn't been able to recruit women. I had asked women to be on committees, and I had asked, you know, Roxy Heisey. I'd asked a lot of different women to be on things. That you know, that they weren't viewed as major donors. I mean, what was wrong with this picture? What was wrong? And, or weren't they being perceived as major donors? Well, we had a problem. Or weren't they giving as major donors? Or what was wrong? So we met as this group, and so that was kind of our start from that feasibility study.
And we being you and Jean Manchester Biddick.
And our group.
And who else?
Juanita Sorensen, and then Alma Barron and Carol Toussaint. Mm. And Marianne Shaw, wife of the president of the university. Yeah. And so I'll talk a little bit more about the development of women's philanthropy. But in the meantime, at the foundation, so I got very interested in that and started to spend some time on that. And in the meantime, then, I started working on that, and I was doing statistical studies on looking at the gender statistics at Wisconsin. And so then what happened is that Bob retired. Bob said, no, I'm not going to do another campaign. And it just, you know, it was too much. And
this would be 1989 or?
No, it was 87.
Oh, 87 that he retired.
Yes, yes. Because Sandy came in 88.
Okay.
And, but then by that time, of course, I had said, well, Bob is going to retire. And I thought, oh. Well, and Gary and I, of course, we had thought, well, we'd like to have another child. And I thought, well, it'd be good to have another child before new president of the foundation came. So then it was lucky I got pregnant, and my child was expected in January of 88. So as it turned out, the timing really wasn't that good for me. I thought it would be better, but because in my mind I thought this would be good because I'd have my child, and then it'd be all settled down and everything before the new president came. But it really backfired because, you see, Bob wasn't there either, because he really wasn't well during that time. So there was really, you know, Tim was there, but really things were not attended to when I was gone. Hmm. And so, you know, I was gone on maternity leave for this time. I said, I am taking maternity leave, even though my husband really said, you'll be sorry. But I said, I don't care, I'm spending time with my baby this time. So I took 3 months off, and then I took another 3 months half-time, and then I continued to work 80% after that. And, but, you know, you can't get much done doing that. Mm-hmm. And then I divvied out all my responsibilities to different people, and you know, things generally had just kind of fell apart during that period, both for my departments and in general. Nobody was paying attention to anything in my departments, even though I had asked them to do it. I found out later things were pretty much of a mess. And so that didn't make me look good when I came back.
And when did you come back then?
In the fall, right when Sandy came back.
Sandy was hired in the fall of 1988, mm-hmm. and that's when you came back.
Yeah. Was it fall or maybe summer, something like that? Because the Women's Council was actually formed in 1988 in the summer. We had been meeting, but we had actually decided to form the Women's Philanthropy Council in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
The actual name of the group and founding a group was the same year, 1988. So, because I was just emerging back from maternity leave.
And now, Martha, had Bob left the foundation by this time?
He was out for quite some time because he hadn't been feeling well with heart problems, which, of course, he eventually died from now this last, just about a month ago, sadly. And he took some leave, and then when he felt better, he came back and then worked part-time for about 5 years
mm-hmm.
in the office next to mine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice.
But I take it that you did not have a role in the hiring of Sandy Wilcox.
No, Jim Vaughn was chair of the board still, and so he was chaired the committee. And I think it was obvious that we should get an outside person. I think none of us should be it. I think Tim thought he should be hired, and that was a problem. I think we hired a consultant, Granzebach & Company, and I asked him for his advice. He said, well, my advice to you is just do your job and keep your heads down, meaning there's going to be a lot of problems between Sandy and Tim. And there was. Because Tim, you know, always felt that he should be in control.
Mm-hmm.
And he was senior vice president for development, and he did a wonderful job. But it was hard for Tim. I don't blame Tim. You know, it was hard. You know.
Did he apply for the job?
Oh yeah, he applied for it, but they said he was too old. But it was more than that. I mean, he hadn't gotten this supervisory experience, and he felt he had it because he had it as a priest. But having supervisory experience as a priest and in the real world is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And supervising women and supervising people, it's very different in a very male hierarchical situation
mm-hmm.
than in a real work situation. And I think that would have helped Tim. I mean, it would have helped me. I mean, the thing is with me is that I made a lot of mistakes in terms of overextending myself.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big mistakes that I would make. That mm-hmm. This is my biggest fault. I always do that. I continue to do that. But I think you mentioned, you know, with age, you better in pacing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I would do that. And I would also, with staff, I think I was too young to know that you couldn't both be friends with your staff and supervise them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that mm-hmm. yet. And so, you know, I tried to be too friendly to them.
Mm-hmm.
I made mistakes like that, but I never went to one class in supervising. But you know, I do have to say I'm lucky that, you know, I have wonderful relations still with Walt Keough and Marion Brown, who I consider my best hires ever, and who are now my colleagues as vice president. But also, I think my taking maternity leave for so long and no one paying attention to my duties and helping out during that period, but there was no mechanism for the foundation, and still at that point there was no accumulated sick leave or anything I had to take or anybody to cover or
mm-hmm.
nothing like that. that really hurt me. So I guess that, but then that made me later, as all things, it made you more sympathetic to women's issues, you see.
Yes.
It made me extremely, because I always felt like it just wasn't fair, you know. And everyone said, well, you did this by choice, or, you know, it's still like the issues with childcare in society, you mm-hmm. know, and still we have Sandy, it still has the issues. Child care is the family's responsibility, and I don't believe that. I believe society, I believe child care is society's responsibility, just
of course.
As education is. But, so, what happened was, I think, people were unhappy with me when I came back, and because I hadn't been doing all my meetings, and Sandy heard about it when he came. And so, as a result of that, he removed me from having all my people reporting to me. And I had left was the Bascom Hill Society as my responsibility. And he took me off the management committee. And, but, you know, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, you know.
Was that a huge blow?
Well, it was in a way, because, you know, here it was like I had known about all the problems of the foundation and, you know, the faults of what had happened before and that the lack of organization and how I had been trying to get these meetings and whatever meetings we had had and that Bob had organized and put together. I was the one that called them. You know, because I knew we needed him.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of looking at me as part of the solution, he looked at me as part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like he had thrown away a lot of potential for the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, but maybe politically he had to do that. And because I was so visible and I had been in contact with so many people on the campus and with so many offices, and I hadn't been doing it. And, well, I hadn't, because I had been out on maternity leave and no one else had been covering me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I got back and found out, you know, that different things hadn't been done, and I was, you know, heartsick about it. But on the other hand, I was glad to spend the time with my son, so,
mm-hmm.
and I never regret that.
No.
And I'm very happy about it. So you have to go on. But
did you contemplate leaving the foundation?
Oh, yes. I definitely did. No doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. But, of course, by that time, Gary's law office had now he had kind of built it up and but there was just definitely a possibility that I definitely could with what I had accomplished. There was no doubt about it, and I was still getting offers and
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. But on the other hand, the same year, 1988, too, that's when I met Sandra Shaw, too. Same exact year. My friend, and who I ended up writing two books with on women's philanthropy. So, you know, one door closes, another one opens, as the old cliche says. But, and I was very involved with my children. And I thought, well, okay, it's all right. I'm just going to be a mom and do this for a while
mm-hmm.
and see what happens. And we were getting cranked up for the campaign. And
this is the Campaign for Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
That was the official name of
right.
it.
Right.
Okay.
And so they were needing to have all these geographic activities. And I said, oh, I can do this, falling out of bed. So I did all these geographic activities with Eileen Murphy. Remember?
Sure.
Eileen Murphy, wonderful person, went on to do great things in development. I'm a development officer herself, but I hired her. She was a homemaker, past homemaker, looking to get back on the job market. And we did all these wonderful things all over the country, and I did a whole series of events with the Pro Arte Quartet on the East Coast.
Oh, that's right, you did.
Yeah, and I had a good time with that.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the kids. And I thought, this is fine. And in the meantime, you know, they were all battling it out in the management meeting. Tim and Sandy. And so I just thought, this is okay with me. It's all right for a while. And the other thing is, I decided that that I would continue my 80% appointment. I decided to do that, and I kind of stood firm on that just because I just wanted the time at home, and I felt like I don't have that extra responsibility at work, and if work doesn't really, you know, it's kind of like, well, I guess they don't want me that much.
Did the board support that 80% appointment, or was that?
Well, I don't think it was even brought up at the board. Later, maybe it was, but I think it was pretty much, you know, that I just kept it. I kept it. See, because Bob had approved it.
Oh, Bob had
approved
it.
Still approved from Bob.
Okay.
But I mean, the difference was this was the difference though, and the shock was. Okay, the last raise I got from Bob Benbrom was 10%. My first raise with Sandy was 0. That's the kind of message I got. It was like, okay, everything you were doing under Bob Rannenbaum was great. And your behavior is great. Your performance is fantastic. And from the board.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sandy comes in and it's like, you're nothing and you're no good. And it's like, what am I supposed to be doing? And it was kind of like, well, this is news to me. And it was very weird.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Bob had sat down with me, it's like, well, yeah, you get a little busy or you get frantic sometimes. But your creativity is great. Your relationship with the donors is great, da, da, da.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have someone new come in who really doesn't like your style is the bottom line.
Right.
And ultimately, that's what it is. Sandy ultimately just has never liked my style. And Bob Rannenbaum did. And, you know, you just have to accept that kind of thing. And I think it's a difficult thing. But again, it's like, he always was able, he likes a different kind of a personality. And Bob Rannenbaum liked my kind of a personality. And so each leader will hire and like certain kinds of people. And that's why you will find changes in management.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be too surprised by that kind of thing. I mean, and so that's why, I mean, it was surprising, but to have that big of a swing was like, whoa, you know.
Particularly after having been in on the ground floor, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
For a decade, more than a decade.
For 13 years, yeah. So it was, I think that was difficult, and I think that early time with Sandy was very difficult because he didn't understand the foundation culture at all,
mm-hmm.
at all. And I think he did not understand Bascom Hill Society, and I was up against it and had the brunt of that. But my other colleagues were up against it as well. But after now, he's been there 18 years. He's accepted the values of the foundation now. They are his. And the Bob Rannenbaum values of the foundation are now Sandy's. They've been accepted.
Are they alive and well?
Yes.
Are they, Martha?
Yes, they are.
I'm glad to hear it.
They are. And Bob knew that before he died.
So did he?
Yes, he did.
Good. This concludes side two of tape 5. This is tape 6, side 1 of the ongoing interview with Martha Taylor, Vice President of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, June 21st, 2006. This segment of the interview, beginning with this tape and this side, will be devoted exclusively to Martha's work in women and philanthropy.
Well, I think one of the key moments for me, which I will repeat on this tape, is the story of the feasibility study for the campaign for Wisconsin, which was a $400 million campaign for the University of Wisconsin Foundation. This feasibility study was in 1987, and it was done for this campaign. And the idea of the feasibility study was that 100 people were to be interviewed to assess their interest in different projects of the university. And all of the schools and colleges were represented, plus other things, on the list of projects given to the people. And the people selected were opinion leaders, and they were selected by the senior development person in our shop. And a couple other of the board people. And these people were interviewed all around the state and nationally. And then the report was given at a foundation board meeting. And the results were handed out. And the schools of education and the School of Human Ecology, the old home economics school, were left off the priority list. They had gotten no votes. And Jean Manchester Biddick, who was a graduate of the School of Human Ecology and a board leader, one of the few women board members, said, why is this? What's wrong? She was on the board of visitors for SOHI and wanted to know why SOHI was left off this list. And then she said, how many women of the 100 were interviewed were women? And the answer was 6. And of course, the student body, the alumni body, is the alumni body of Wisconsin at that time were about 40% women, 35-40% women, and the student body was about 50%. So to have 6 women interviewed out of 100, and you see the response was going to be, of course, that education and SOHI were not listed high. Mm-hmm. So it showed a huge problem that the women were not perceived as major donors, as opinion leaders. And it showed a second problem, that if you don't have women to sit around the table and be asked in these kinds of situations, that universities are not going to raise money for things that women care about. So it, just that story was a huge eye-opening experience for me. Right after the meeting, Jean and I huddled in a back corner, and she said, you go and call the dean of the School of Human Ecology, Hammer Coven, and tell him what happened, and tell him to call the acting chancellor, Bernie Cohen, and ask that the school be in the campaign. So Hammer Coven did call Bernie Cohen, and Bernie assured him that the school would be in the campaign, as the other schools were. But, you know, one never knows if they would have been or not. But the issue is that the women were not asked and not perceived as donors. And so Jean said, we had to do something about this. So she said, let's get a little group together. And so we talked on the phone about who that little group should be. And so we got together. We picked some high-level people who we thought would be good. Marianne Shaw, who was the wife of the president then of the UW system, Kenneth Shaw, because she had expressed some interest in women's leadership. Kay Vaughn, she was the wife of Jim Vaughn, who was then the chairman of the board of the foundation, the volunteer chair, but also I had known them because Jim had been chair of the Bascom Hill Society, the major donor club, for many, many years. And I knew Kay was very devoted to the School of Human Ecology and also to women's leadership. She had been a homemaker for many years, but she was very interested in that issue and in women's philanthropy as well. And Jean had been a homemaker, but then had gone into business. So she kind of wore both hats. Alma Barron was a professor at the university in business and had been in TV, and she was a teacher of business seminars to women, so very interested in women's leadership issues. Carol Toussaint was a woman in Madison who's been a mentor to women just over many, many years. Been in the utilities, been in active in politics, was president of the National League of Women Voters. So a very active woman leader. And Valerie Manis, also active in the community. And Juanita Sorensen, a retired professor at UW-Eau Claire, and then had moved to Madison and been active in Madison. So we met, and we had a couple of meetings, and they asked me to do a little study to look at the statistics of what the giving was at the foundation over time. You know, like over the last 5 years, and I, you know, can't remember the exact number of years, but what it was is the number of women givers at what different levels, and then the percentage they were in the student body, the percentage they were in the alumni body, these kind of statistics. The other thing is that I wanted to find is how they were credited. So I had to take like the top 20 gifts and then really look at, had we properly credited the gift as to really what I had thought? And I asked Bob Rannebaum, you know, did he, how he thought they had been credited, you know, and, or John Felt, you know, how is this person really gave, that kind of thing. And what I was amazed at was really the level of giving. And the statistics have remained actually pretty steady over the years in that the women have been giving at the really top of the giving level and at the lower giving level. And where they don't give as much as men is kind of in that middle range. And we've always puzzled at that, but it's kind of maybe when women feel more secure, they start, in their older age, they start to give more.
Martha, when you did these statistics, how did you handle gifts from married couples?
Well, we were lucky because the foundation at that time, largely because of Bob Rannebaum, had the policy of splitting gifts.
Okay.
Equally. So I counted on that, and we were lucky. And I also do have to say that before I came to the foundation, Bob Rannebaum had tried to start a women's giving program.
Really?
Yes. And that the big joke of this whole thing is that Bob Rannebaum was really the founder of the Women's Philanthropy Council at the UW Foundation. In that he knew the women had money. He just didn't know how to work on it. He didn't know how to set it up. He hired a person called Director of Women's Affairs.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Before you?
Oh, yes. Because that wasn't my responsibility, and he had kind of dropped that idea because it didn't work. And this person actually was there while John Felt was working. He hired an older woman, and it was, let's see, it must have been like 1970, maybe a little bit before, 68. An older woman, and unfortunately, she'd go to alumni. All she'd end up doing was going to social events.
Uh-huh.
Because I don't think she really would go to development conferences or really know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried her best, I mean, but she just went and did go to social events. And so she was just doing more public relations. But so it didn't work out, but he tried it. He knew the market was out there. The other thing that he and Ted Zillman did was they set up these Saturday seminars called Women's Financial Planning Seminars. And they were on Saturdays, and they had one every spring, and they would bring in a speaker for lunch, and then they would have speakers on estate planning and like a local lawyer and, you know, planning your will and investments. And then they had, and Catherine Clary, one of our great women alumni, was a speaker 1 year, and then they'd have different faculty speak. Well, I think they did it for 3 years, and then the women asked, can we bring our husbands? So then they did it as family financial planning. And that's where, when Tim Riley came to the foundation in development, he, as plan giving director, he picked that name up, and not only did we start to do the program at the foundation Saturday in the spring, but we started to do all those all over the country then, because
mm-hmm.
they were a successful format. That was before the banks and everybody got into the business.
Mm-hmm.
But they started as the Women's Financial Seminar. So, and those were in addition to the Alumni Association always had day on campus for women every spring. So we kind of knew there was that constituency out there. But so Bob had worked on that, and I remember seeing like a gift chart, women's gifts to the Elvium Museum campaign, you know. But he just took the regular gift chart and put women's gift chart, you know. But so he was thinking about it, and he knew about it. And part of it was because, you know, he always had such a partnership relationship with Jean, his wife. And he had such a good relationship with her and his two daughters, and they always made their decisions about philanthropy together. They had a partnership. I mean, it wasn't a hierarchical thing. So he knew that you needed to involve the wife in the decision making.
Uh-huh.
So, but he didn't quite know how to do it. So it wasn't Bob. Bob always knew to involve women. So he was always good to find women. And, he was wonderful with, for example, the Mead family, the Mead paper family.
Consolidated Paper.
They all sent the boys of the family to schools out east and everything. They sent the girls close to home. I think they wanted them close to home. But all those girls, we've continued all those relationships with all those women, you know, and, Those relationships were all started because of Bob Rinnemann.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about Sally Mead Hands
and
Emily.
Sally Mead Hands, Emily Mead. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Emily McKay. Yeah. And there was Emily's mother, and Ed Young and Bob used to go visit her in Wisconsin Rapids. So they knew that. That kind of thing. But, so it depends on the personality. But see, Tim Riley was different. He was in charge of this feasibility study, and he was more interested in the men. And that's more, that's Sandy Wilcox, too. So you see, what I say is, we would never have a Women's Philanthropy Council if it wasn't for Sandy Wilcox, if it wasn't for Tim Riley, because we wouldn't have needed one.
How interesting.
Yes. We would have never had one. Yeah. Because we may have had one, but it wouldn't have been in the form or in the... It wouldn't have been driven so much. Because it was so obvious, the audience that they were focusing on, which was the white male, you know, CEO of a certain income, that And maybe we had overlooked them too, but they were definitely overlooking this other audience. And so it was just, and the time was right. And but I think that that sometimes happens when I gave a speech one time when I got the YWCA award. A friend in research, Kathy Mansistine, had given me a speech about foes and how sometimes foes really drive you to do things. Mm-hmm. And this was true in this case. In that they crystallize your thinking on things because it's so clear. So with Bob, he understood this relationship building development.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't like about what Sandy was telling us and bringing to the table, which we have now changed, we meaning my other colleagues, was this more slash and burn fundraising,
mm-hmm.
this sales mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like this mindset that I was seeing also from other colleagues from around the country. I was seeing this at conferences. It was more a sales and there's a marketing. To say that fundraising is not development. It's fundraising and it's just another marketing decision. It's mm-hmm. another purchasing decision. And I remember hearing that from, for example, when I went to Stanford to make a speech on Women's Philanthropy, that a guy from the Stanford office said that to me. And I said, and this is where Sandy is from. So it made me kind of understand a little bit. Although, you know, he had some good foundations, obviously, well. But still, our more softer relationship-building approach is more comfortable for women. Okay. So this gives you kind of some background in it. Now, yet still, even Bob had, I mean, we had to bring up the visibility of women. And there were some issues related to women, period, that it's just, and I'll talk about those in a minute, but let me talk a little bit about some defining moments at this period of time. In the constituencies that we were hiring all these people for, the constituencies, we were hiring business, engineering, law, and so on. But then we weren't hiring so many for LNS. We didn't hire education. So I was stuck as the person responsible for constituencies, raising the money for those. And I was told that, well, the primary constituency of those are women. And I was told, you know, by Bob, we couldn't justify hiring someone because the women, you know, weren't going to give.
Huh.
As much. Okay? And I questioned that. And even Tim thought, well, I don't know, school teachers, some of them are pretty generous. But, you know, so that was something that really bothered me. So, and I thought, well, I'm even asked him. So there was these questions. But then again, this study, I'd done this study and looked at it, and what it found was that the women were really giving quite generously, but where they weren't giving was kind of at the point of time where they could get a little more visibility for feasibility study purposes, that they were probably giving more at the end of their lifetimes, where men were kind of giving more to get visibility a little bit earlier in their lifetimes, where
mm-hmm.
they were at their opinion leader peak,
mm-hmm.
and they were getting, so they were, you know, that's, so I was feeling maybe we need to have some education for women to give a little more earlier to, because we need their opinions around the table. I mean, that's kind of where we came to the conclusion that we need to work on this. We need to teach leveraging skills to women because we need their voices around the table. I mean, that was kind of the initial reason we got together and said we need a Women's Philanthropy Council because we need those voices around the table because something like that is not going to happen again on our watch.
Martha, I have to assume that Jean Manchester Biddick was critical here. In providing both support and protection for you to do this work.
Oh, tremendous. And the other thing is, she just gave a little money. She said, she gave like $5,000, but it was like $1 million. She said, I just want to give $5,000 to, she gave it to a fund in Sohi for, whatever you're going to do with women's philanthropy. Wow. I mean, that was huge. That was just like $1 million.
Oh, she gave it dedicated to women and philanthropy.
Yeah. That was huge.
Yeah.
I mean, that was giant. I mean, just, I mean, because that was a small idea. And so, then, I had just finished that study, and then there was an article, same year, in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And it was about a meeting at the University of North Carolina. And it reported on a certain trustee talking. And the headline, you know, was blasting out. And I got a whole bunch of people sent me this article. And it said something like, North Carolina wants to threatens to cap enrollment for women. And I went, what? And sure enough, this trustee in this article was maintaining that because women's giving tends to follow their husband's giving, goes to their husband's alma mater, not to their alma mater, that they should cap the number of women attending Chapel Hill.
Wow!
And, I mean, that was like fuel to the fire. Until this day, that will keep me going for the rest of my life. I mean, it was like, what? And so I quote that article to this day. Now.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. And because it's like I am saying, and I say to audiences now, I say, women, if you haven't thought about that your patterns of giving might affect a life, think of it. You might be keeping someone from going to college because of your giving habits. So please think about them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
just amazing.
I mean, isn't that a shock?
It's a huge shock. I did not know that, Martha.
Yeah. And literally, it was a quoting from a trustees meeting, and it was a long article. And of course, the trustees did not set the enrollment limits. But the fact this was a front page article, a debate on this, it was, you know, very controversial. Well, okay. I brought this to our next meeting, and, you know, here, and I thought, my heavens, am I the only one in the country that has these kind of statistics on women's giving? And I thought, I guess I am. You know, I mean, it was like the grand aha moment. It was like, oh my heavens, help us. It was like a shock. Uh-huh. It's still overwhelming to me at this moment. You know, to think that no one had looked at this and that it was such a huge policy issue about women being entered into college and just all kinds of ramifications of decision making. But these myths were out there about women's philanthropy and what other myths were out there. So I brought this back, and of course this group was just, well, we have to do something about this. And so that's when we formed, it was then called the Council on Women's Giving, later called the Women's Philanthropy Council at Wisconsin.
And are you into 1989 yet, Martha?
Yeah. We're moving in 1989, but I have to mention that I also, in 1988, the same year, because it was Sandy was making his initial welcome to Madison. He was invited to join to speak at NSFRE, National Society Fundraising Executives Talk. And I went to it, and because I'm a member, and I sat next to this woman who had just moved to Madison from Washington, D.C., and her name was Sandra Shaw. And I was telling her about this group we had and what we were doing on women's philanthropy, because I thought, oh, just people from the East Coast, they're going to know everything. And about women's philanthropy, they're sure. And I said, do you know anything about, you know, women's philanthropy? And she thought I was talking about women development officers. And I said, no, I'm talking about women as donors. And she said, oh, that's so interesting. You know how Sandra can be. That's so interesting. Well, tell me all about it. So we just got along famously and had lunch after that, and she just got very interested in this whole topic. And then we became friends, and then going into 89, at that time, I had gone to a conference, I think Case Conference, by fall of that year, I had been in communication because I was active professionally. Was it that fall? It must have been the 88. No, it wasn't 88 because I made a case presentation the prior year. No, it was when I was pregnant with Ben that I made the presentation on the gender data. So it was 87.
Uh-huh.
87 at Case, I made the presentation on the data. And then it was 88 that we formed the council. So this Judy Nichols had been in the audience, because I remember being, because I had been January 6th, so I was 9 months pregnant, or 8 months, you know. You know, I remember giving this presentation, being so pregnant, on the data. And then at Case, and Judy Nichols, who is an expert in demographics and that kind of thing, has written many books on that, was in the audience. And then she had written to me, and there was going to be a whole issue in NSFRE magazine on changing demographics, and she wanted me to do an article on an issue of women's philanthropy. And so that was kind of the first time I was asked to do an article on it. And so I just met this new friend, Sandra Shaw, and so we were talking about, well, and I said, well, Sandra, would you like to write this article with me? So that was when we first started our writing together. So going into 88, 89. And that was when we decided to... Sandra had just read about doing focus groups. So we decided, so we had lunch and we thought, oh, let's do some focus groups, but with different age groups, because we were going to do this on just career women. And we decided to do it on a little older group and a little younger group. And so we did this at the Madison Club. And it was kind of our first times with women philanthropists. And it just blew us away. I mean, the results, that was kind of what showed us that really more research was needed. And it was certainly much different than results from men. And, I mean, it was pretty amazing. And
what was most amazing, Martha?
Oh, we had people like Jane Coleman in town, who is a very highly respected person. You'd think one very businesslike and so on. So speaking so emotionally about her own giving, and then kind of saying at the end, she said, you know, I really never can say no to those people that talk about giving, you know, a bicycle and for somebody over in, you know, some third world country or something like that. You know, I mean, just these little stories of, she says, I know it costs so much for overhead, but it's such an appealing thing and I really want to help that person. I mean, just different little things like this, and that were just, you would never think. And Nancy Mead, who is in town, a great woman, who's given to many things, nature and many things. And we got wonderful quotes that we later used in our book. And she said, we asked about donor recognition. All she said is, I want to see the human face my gift affects. Isn't that a great quote?
Wonderful.
I love that quote. You know, so it showed me that, you know, women, you know, you just don't give them facts and figures. I mean, Jane Coleman, you know, who likes to know how the endowment is doing and facts and figures. She responded to this direct mail about this kid with a bicycle and, mm-hmm. you know, that this was, they really wanted more involvement and really this very emotional level. I think that was something very interesting. So we did it on but also one of the other things that was very interesting to us was they did not want to be stereotypes, stereotypical interest of giving to women's interests. You know, that women are interested in X, and because I'm a woman, I want to give to whatever it is, you know. And yet, okay, so it was the way we structured our questions. Are you interested in women's issues, or are you interested in whatever? And then, you know, at the end of the hour and a half,